at Allaire.com.
I'm Christopher Layden. This is The Connection. Eric Schlosser's reporting on Fast Food Nation could remind you of that book we all read in high school, The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's historic Rats in the Sausage expose of the meatpacking industry a century ago. Eric Schlosser's book is not the usual health food rant against the virtually addictive mix of grease and sugar and salt and all those burgers and fries, although it does add to the lore of the chemical additives that give it what we think is the taste of potatoes and beef. The broader sweep of Eric Schlosser's account covers the transformation of Idaho, the potato state. The fear among cattle ranchers that they could go the way of chicken farmers into debt and factory production of foodstuffs. He's interested in a dietary revolution that comes hand in hand with a new teenage minimum wage class of fast food workers and a new science of marketing to children who recognize Ronald McDonald and the Golden Arches logo before they know their own name. Connection listeners, citizens of Fast Food Nation, is there any going back? 1 in 8 of us have worked in fast food. Have you got a story to tell? It's fast. It's cheap. Is it out of control? Do we deserve a break today from McDonald's? The takeout phone is 1-800-423-8255. Give Eric Schlosser a call on the Connection phone, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at theconnection.org. Eric Schlosser, this is a brave book, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Obviously, you're up against billions of dollars in advertising, not to mention production investments, but could you just start by inventorying some of the effects that you've identified in Fast Food Nation, starting maybe with farmers, beef farmers, chicken farmers?
Sure. In the book, I try to use fast food and the fast food industry as a way of looking at American history over the last 25 years. So in some cases, the fast food industry has played a central role in major changes in our economic and social life. And in other cases, it's just reflective of changes that were going on elsewhere in society. So I don't want to say that the fast food industry is responsible for everything in American life, but you mentioned agriculture, and there's no question that the purchasing needs of the fast food chains have played a major role in changing how our food is prepared. When you look at the food, when you get a burger at one of these places, it looks like a burger that you got 25 years ago, but it's very, very different. There are now about 14,000 McDonald's in the United States. Their demand for ground beef is enormous. They want their ground beef to be exactly the same and taste exactly the same at all of these outlets. So they have really encouraged the development of a highly industrialized system of meatpacking with gigantic hamburger grinders, and that has had consequences on how cattle are raised on the ranch and how the meat is processed.
Speak about it. What difference does it make to the ranchers and then the farm workers too, or the landowners?
Well, in the case of ranchers, let's use 1968 as a starting point. There were 1,000 McDonald's in 1968. And that year, the top four meatpacking companies controlled about 20% of the market for cattle in the United States. Today, there are 14,000 McDonald's, and the top four meatpacking companies control over 80% of the market for cattle. Mm. So if you're a rancher and you have cattle to sell, you're kind of in the same position as if you're an airline passenger and you're in a city that's only served by one airline. Anyone who flies out of a city that's an airline hub finds that the service and the fare that you're going to pay can be not to your advantage. And if you're a rancher and you're trying to sell your cattle, it really is not a competitive marketplace for cattle.
I was fascinated that you say they dread what happened to the poultry industry.
Explain. Right. And what's amazing to me is when I wrote that, every independent rancher's fear was that the meatpacking companies were going to try to do what the poultry companies have done. I mean, poultry growers in this country are little more than surf might be too strong a word, but they are so heavily indebted to the big poultry companies. The poultry companies own the birds. And yet the poultry grower has to make all the investments in the capital infrastructure and really cannot compete for price with other poultry processors. And in a very brief period of time, the poultry industry has gotten almost total control over the growers. Since the book was written, IBP, the largest beef company in the United States, is about to be purchased by Tyson. And Tyson really perfected these grower contracts in poultry. And ranchers now have even more reason to fear that they're going to lose what independence they have left.
You make a point, just an aside in the book, that there are more people in prison now than are actively engaged in farm production. I wonder what effect would you say Fast Food Nation has had on farm workers, the migrants, but also the dirt farmers?
Well, you know, it hasn't had as much of an effect on migrant workers because there are so few fresh fruits and vegetables that are part of the menu, and that's where the migrant hand labor is being done. But at the same time, again, the gigantic uniform purchasing needs of the fast food chains has really encouraged the rise of gigantic processors and agribusiness companies to supply them. And just like in the beef industry, the concentration in the potato industry has meant that independent farmers and growers of potatoes have few places to sell their potatoes. What you're seeing in the American landscape is increasing corporate control of the landscape and fewer independent farmers. And what's so ironic about this is if you go back 20, 25 years, when we were in the midst of the Cold War, a great argument against the Soviet system was America had the most efficient agriculture in the world, and the reason it had such an efficient agriculture is because we had millions of independent farmers who were ingenious and coming up with all kinds of new products as opposed to their highly socialized, centralized agriculture. And yet in the last 20 years, it's remarkable how our agriculture has been centralized, not socialized, but taken over by large corporations. And this has a huge impact for consumers that they may not be aware of, not just the price of foods, but without idealizing the family farm in a sentimental way, it is true that people who are on the land for generations and have a commitment to the land have a stake in their communities and have a stake in farming practices that companies that view the land just as another commodity or that view the cattle as just units of production don't have the same kind of stake in it. And this can have ultimately disastrous implications, as it has had for Soviet agriculture.
Of course, the mechanization and the corporate ownership of farming was happening before and rather independently. Is that an effect of the fast food revolution, or is it sort of a parallel development?
Well, you know, it's been happening for most of this century. But the last 20 years just represent an acceleration of the process that's extraordinary. Mm. And it's not even a question of using new technology or not using it. I mean, I would never argue for a return for using horse-drawn plows in our fields. And yet different technologies have very different consequences. And if you look at the meatpacking industry, for example, you see technologies being used that are imposing enormous costs on consumers, but which these meatpacking companies are able to get away with quite profitably. The long-term consequences of some of these agriculture practices are not being taken into account by these meatpacking companies, which are very short-term oriented, very quarterly profit-oriented. If you look at the cost, for example, of E. coli 0157H7 and the social costs of that and the medical costs of that, the meatpacking companies have been fairly well able to avoid that. And in the same way, if you look in Europe at the mad cow outbreak, that's a perfect example of the huge industrialized agriculture having all kinds of unintended consequences. And somebody outside of these companies really has to be looking at the long-term view in a way that they're not right now.
Connection listeners, the phone's 1-800-423-8255. The central argument in Eric Schlosser's book begins with the thought that what we eat has changed more in the last 40 years than in 40,000 years before that, but also that it has enormous effects across the whole spectrum of American industry, landowning, working conditions. Would you speak a little bit, Eric, about your reporting in the slaughterhouses? This incredibly, inescapably bloody scene with mostly foreign workers sort of aiming their knives for that thrust at the carotid artery. What's happened to meatpacking work?
What's happened to meatpacking work, again, since the early 1970s, alongside the rise of the big fast food chains, is that what once was one of the most highly paid manufacturing jobs in the United States is now one of the lowest paid manufacturing jobs in the United States, and it's also the most dangerous job in the United States with the highest injury rate. The large meatpacking companies have really done a very good job at breaking unions, of recruiting illegal immigrants and recent immigrant workers from deep in the heart of Mexico and Guatemala. These workers are very unlikely to protest working conditions. And if you looked at the line speed, the production line speed in a modern slaughterhouse in the United States, in the 70s it was about 175 cattle per hour. Now it's anywhere from 300 to 400 cattle per hour. Because cattle come in all different sizes and shapes, there are not machines that can process them in the same way that many poultry plants are highly mechanized. So most of the work in a modern slaughterhouse, most of the crucial work, is still being done by hand with workers holding very sharp knives, working very close to one another. And as they speed up the pace of the production line, people get hurt. They stab themselves. They stab someone next to them. They get all kinds of cumulative trauma injuries. And this is of enormous importance, not just for these workers who are hidden away in these towns in Colorado and Nebraska, and most Americans have no idea this is going on, but it's also of real importance to anyone who eats the meat, because when workers are working quickly and under enormous pressure and stress, they're more likely to make mistakes that can lead to contamination of the meat.
Talk about how quickly. I mean, you write that that lethal thrust that opens the gusher of blood comes every 10 seconds for a slaughterhouse worker. Every 10 seconds he's making that kind of bullfighter's move.
It's an incredible, incredible pace. And I felt as though I really needed, you know, I'd met a lot of these workers. I'd gone into their homes. I'd spent time with them. But I really felt as though I needed to see for myself how this process works. And you know, the slaughter of big animals is always going to be messy and unpleasant work and probably always dangerous. And yet it is dangerous far beyond what it needs to be right now. And my visit to the slaughterhouse didn't turn me into a vegetarian. I mean, I'm still a meat eater and I still eat beef. But it left me absolutely appalled by the working conditions and by the pace of the work and the stress of the work. And I cannot tell you how many people who I've met who have been really disabled by the work and lifelong injuries.
Eric, we'll take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk also about work at the retail level. It's the biggest employment industry in the country. Most workers under age 20. We're talking about Fast Food Nation with Eric Schlosser. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection with Christopher Lydon, how to look at things. The guest...
French fries, the double cheeseburgers, the fish fries, and the shakes.
I have to say I love the French fries.
I do too. I love the double shakes. The shakes are good too. Even the eggnog.
In the past couple of years, we've gone to a new system of production where the actual orders from the registers appear on a screen in the back area, and then each sandwich is individually produced as the customer orders it. Okay? And that's called the made-for-you system that we went to.
Does fast food make your life easier?
Yes, it's very easy. You come here for dinner, have salads and everything. Stay here all the day.
Breakfast,
yeah,
lunch.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
What do you order usually?
Number 6.
Do you like the French fries?
Yeah. Yeah, they're like the best part. Yeah, and the Coke. And we don't like come here every day, and so that doesn't really affect us that bad.
So you think it's bad for you?
No. If you eat it, like, smartly, it's not going to be bad for you.
But is it delicious?
Yeah.
What makes it so delicious?
I don't know, because it's all fast.
We've developed grills that can cook on both sides. A regular hamburger or cheeseburger is cooked roughly 38 to 42 seconds on both sides simultaneously.
Marina, how often do you guys eat at McDonald's?
Every weekend.
What do you order when you come here?
Chicken nuggets and french fries.
Obviously, the fries are the most popular in McDonald's. They have been for years. The sandwiches and from that line, the chicken products have become predominant and taking over the Big Mac. Nuggets in particular, because of the kids, it's a finger food, that type of thing. They like it particularly well.
What do you order when you come?
I'm a muffin and coffee guy. You know, I get the sundae every now and then just to see how the other half lives, of course. Or dies, whichever way you want to put it.
Eric Schlosser, that's what you're up against. People love those fries. Do you have to be, I mean, what's the risk here of being an elitist or just a crank? My kids thought I was a crank for not letting them pig out at McDonald's.
Well, I'm not an elitist at all. I mean, I think the food tastes great, and I've eaten more fast food over the years than I could ever measure. There are some companies that are serving exactly the same food that have very responsible business practices. And the food tastes really good at the major chains. It's been very carefully designed to taste that way. But the consequences of this industry and many of its costs are not reflected in the menu. Mm. Now, to say some good things about the industry, the food's inexpensive. It's convenient. It tastes good. They've put playgrounds there, which is significant because a lot of communities have stopped building playgrounds. It's working class food for families, and those are good things. But again, one of the reasons that I wrote the book, as someone who's eaten fast food all of his life and used to take his kids to these places, is that behind that surface, it's a huge industry that has changed our food in many ways. So the food looks the same, but it's actually manufactured in entirely different ways and has all kinds of labor policies that if you were to project onto the rest of the economy, would really not be a healthy thing for this country.
Let's talk about why it tastes so good, and what in the world does it have to do with potatoes or beef?
Well, it tastes so good because this is some of the most heavily processed food that's sold in the United States. I mean, just about all the food that enters a fast food kitchen has been frozen or freeze-dried or canned. And when you process this food, the processing techniques destroy most of its flavor. So there is a whole new industry that has arisen mainly in New Jersey, off the New Jersey Turnpike, that manufactures the flavor, not just for most of the fast food that we eat, but for most of the processed food that we eat. These are chemical additives that are added to the food in minute amounts, but it's... I mean, I visited one of these plants, and it's just unbelievable. It's like out of a science fiction film or Willy Wonka. These chemical additives often have more ingredients in the additive than if you look at the list of ingredients on the food. Hmm. So, you know...
But how do you get, say, the strawberry flavor of a fast food shake?
Well, you add together literally dozens of different aroma chemicals. The flavor industry came out of the perfume industry. Originally, these perfume companies had an expertise in making smells from all kinds of essential oils. So as the processed food industry grew, and a huge proportion, often up to 90% of the flavor of your food is its aroma, turn to the perfume companies to make the flavors for their food. So, for example, for a artificial strawberry flavor that's in a fast food shake, they will combine dozens and dozens of chemicals that it reads like it's like a chemistry textbook. They'll create this additive, they'll put it in the shake, and when the shake enters your mouth, the chemical aromas are released and you smell the strawberry shake, and it creates the impression that you're having strawberry. But there isn't necessarily anything dangerous about this, but it's a really a sign and a symptom of how this food has much more in common with a manufactured commodity than it does with anything that you'd make in your kitchen.
Are they real sesame seeds?
They're real sesame seeds, indeed.
1-800-423-8255 makes the fast food connection with Eric Schlosser, whose book is called Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. 1-800-423-TALK. William is on the line.
Yes, when about 30 years ago when I was in college, I had a summer job working at a plant that made a dry potato-flavored starch, which we packaged in 40-pound buckets and which were shipped to all of the fast food places. And there they would measure the starch out, mix it with water into a paste, and extrude the paste through a machine that made essentially French fries. And then they were fried up, and that's what a French fry was in those days. And I have not eaten at a fast food place since because their fries never even got close to a potato. And I'm wondering if the fries nowadays are...
You mean to say there were no potatoes in the fries?
No, it strictly was a dry chemical. It was a potato-flavored starch. It was mixed with water into a paste, extruded, then fried, and that's what was a French fry, at least in the early 70s. Just like while I worked there, I learned that the reason many of the fast food places called their shakes shakes and not milkshakes is at the time there was no milk in any of them. So I'm wondering if that is still the same. It's just a curiosity because, as I say, since I worked there, I have not since that time eaten at any fast food place even once.
Once burned, twice shy.
The French fries at McDonald's and Burger King and the big chains are in fact made from potatoes and from russet Burbank potatoes that are. I visited one of the factories. It's just incredible. These incredibly elaborate machinery that peels the potatoes automatically, cuts them, fries them. What's interesting about McDonald's fries, which really do taste the best, is that little extra something, that little extra flavor you can't put your finger on. Is a chemical additive made at one of these flavor factories. And McDonald's won't reveal exactly what that additive is, except they do acknowledge that it's derived from animal products. So it's most likely from beef. So vegetarians should probably steer clear of McDonald's fries, which taste delicious, but which do have this strange extra something.
1-800-423-8255 makes the fast food connection. Jill is on the line.
Yes, hello, and thank you. Oh, my God. Thank you so much, Mr. Schlosser, for this this book. I have to admit, I've not yet read it. I've read several excerpts and reviews, and it is, I purchased it. It is on
the first chapter, I should say, is on our website, theconnection.org. Check it out.
Bravo. In the meantime, I have bought it. It's on my nightstand. Two questions for you. Well, I mean, I could go on and on, but let me focus on two questions, please. The first is, in this particular country, the use of prophylactic use of antibiotics in farm animals. I know that 10 years ago, over 30% of all antibiotics sold in the United States went to the farming industry, and we're all certainly aware of drug-resistant strains of bacteria today and its impact on us and what we're faced. But that's my first question. My second one is a bit more unsavory, and that's the idea of, I did spend unspeakable time at a slaughterhouse prior to becoming a vegetarian, unlike you. And at that particular time, which was many years ago, animals were slaughtered. And mind you, this is before the frantic pace of which you speak these days. These poor slaughterers in the industry who have to kill at the rate of 10 seconds per animal. I can't imagine. But even back then, animals were actually, they were slashed and then actually skinned before they were totally dead. And I know it's really dreadful. We can speak to, any number of implications, from civility to the idea of adrenaline in the animals, et cetera, et cetera. And could you please just speak to those, if you would?
Sure.
And I also have to defend Chris because I, too, am a crank, and working with inner-city youth, we do not visit fast food restaurants. So
stick with it, Jill. Thank you.
Well, the antibiotic livestock link is one of the great dirty secrets of America at the moment. People are told not to take too many antibiotics because of the growing resistance to antibiotics. But the real problem is the amount of antibiotics being included in animal feed, both poultry and in cattle feed, not because the animals are sick, but because they found that it does encourage growth just a little bit and just enough to make it profitable to do. So The statistics vary, but some people think that more than half of the antibiotics now being manufactured are being included in feed. And in some cases, it is being included as a prophylactic to prevent infections because at the huge feedlots now, where, you know, up to 100,000 cattle are living close to one another and basically living in their own manure, infections are more likely. Our modern industrialized agriculture, in many ways, is creating all kinds of public health risks for the future that these companies don't have to pay for. So that's a very good point. As to the inhumane slaughter of animals, it does still occur. While I was in the slaughterhouse, I saw one terrible incident of an animal not yet dead getting caught in the conveyor belt. But there is much more pressure on these companies to be careful about it. And as a matter of fact, this summer, McDonald's issued very strict rules to its suppliers about the humane treatment of animals and that it would not tolerate inhumane slaughter. And it was under enormous pressure from PETA to do that. And I would like to see McDonald's now issue strict rules to its suppliers about the humane treatment of human beings. I think McDonald's has enormous power to change many of the practices in the meatpacking industry because it's the largest purchaser of beef in the United States.
1-800-423-TALK is the takeout phone. Leslie is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome, Leslie.
I was wondering, I think you answered this a little bit earlier, that you aren't only speaking about McDonald's, though we keep bringing that name up, but this includes the Burger Kings as well.
That's right.
And I was just wondering, is there any way to do this mass production of food on in a healthy way? I mean, you know, is there any way to make it, consumer viable and profitable for people to get into as a business, especially where you mentioned that how many people it's employing right now and how much that must mean to our economy?
It's not a question of eliminating the fast food industry. It's not a question of putting these companies out of business. It's really about changing how they do business. And you can look, I mean, in the book I write about one chain that's incredibly successful in California, the In-N-Out Burger chain, that all of the food is prepared fresh. The workers are paid well. There's a long-term commitment to the workers. And if you look at modern agriculture in other countries right now and food safety systems in other countries, we are unusual in the degree to which we have allowed the concentration of agriculture and the power of these big agribusiness firms. I mean, Australia is a huge exporter of beef and a big beef country. In an Australian slaughterhouse, the cattle are killed at a rate of about 115 cattle an hour, and the meatpacking workers are paid very well. In the Netherlands, which has a really tough food safety system, the cattle are slaughtered at a rate of about 70 cattle an hour. And there are all kinds of ways that without destroying the fast food industry, we can make them change their business practices so that it doesn't have the same health consequences for the people who eat it. And it would not triple the price of your burger by any means. It just means encouraging a real diversity and competition and moving away not from all technology, but moving towards technology that's sustainable in the long run. And
who's going to enforce that, Eric? I mean, are you talking about federal antitrust laws or state regulation or what?
Well,
is a regulated industry.
It's a barely regulated industry. I mean, the federal government does not have the power to order the recall of contaminated meat that can poison thousands. But the federal government can order the recall of a stuffed animal that has a glass eye that might fall off. I mean, it's remarkable how the meatpacking industry has fought off regulation for more than a century now.
Despite Upton Sinclair.
Well, you know, despite Upton Sinclair, what's tragic about the meatpacking industry is that for the next 40 years after The Jungle was published, working conditions were improved by workers fighting for their rights. And again, as I mentioned earlier, this was a highly paid job as recently as the mid-1970s. What's tragic is that in the last 20 years, you have an instance of things actually getting much worse after an effort over decades to make them better. Now, it would be easy to just say government should do this and government should do that, but given the government that we have right now, I think it's highly unlikely that government's going to do any of the important things that need to be done. Consumer power should not be underestimated. Nobody's forced to buy fast food, and the fast food industry is so competitive at the moment, and the market is so saturated, that I think these companies are in a position right now to listen to consumers and to make the changes themselves, much more likely to do it now than even 10 years ago.
The thing that seems to me they've got to worry about, and I wonder if this is a rational fear, is the kind of mad cow panic that's very, very serious in Europe these days. People really scared stiff about putting beef into their mouth. Is that something to worry about? Is that something for consumers to worry about here? Is it something for rational or not for the fast food companies to worry about?
Well, it's something the fast food companies are extremely worried about. I mean, McDonald's business has been really hurt, and all the chains business have been hurt in Europe. But, you know, it's, again, a question of are they willing to take a long-term view, or are they just looking at the next quarterly profit statement? I mean, I'm not apocalyptic about mad cow. So far, thank God, it hasn't been discovered here. It may never come here. But there are certain agricultural practices going on in this country right now that make no sense, and if we were to get mad cow, would just spread it throughout this entire country. I mean, I lived in England for 3 years, so I cannot donate blood because of the risk of mad cow. But right now, as we speak, cattle in America are being fed cattle blood. Poultry in America are being fed huge amounts of rendered cattle slaughterhouse waste. Now, in Europe, these practices are completely banned. And there is some indication that these prions and mad cow can cross species. There's absolutely no justification for feeding these animal proteins to animals that evolved over thousands of years not being cannibals and not eating this stuff. It's just a little bit more profitable to do that. It's a cheap protein supplement. But if you look at the long-term health considerations, you would think that this industry would have learned.
Eric Schlosser, we'll come back to the thought. Stand by. We're talking about Fast Food Nation with the writer Eric Schlosser. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in hour number two of The Connection with Christopher Lydon, what we see is
career opportunities at Allaire.com.
In Paris, you can buy beer at McDonald's. And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
No, man, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know what the fuck a quarter pounder is.
Then what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King.
We're talking with Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation about the dark side of the all-American meal. We haven't talked about McJobs. We haven't talked about McTelevision advertising either. But you write a lot about the real quality of burger flipping jobs. What about it?
Let me just finish that last point about mad cow, which is that I'm less worried about mad cow right now than I am about a meatpacking industry that has such a short-sighted view of its business. About burger flipping, what's remarkable when you think about today's American economy, you think about high tech and software and all of those things. But over the last 20 years, the restaurant industry has become America's biggest private sector employer. Hmm. And it's chosen a certain labor organization that relies on, instead of a small, stable, well-paid, well-trained workforce, they've deliberately pursued a part-time, unskilled workforce that'll work for low wages and no benefits. And that's had a huge impact on the rest of our service sector economy.
Hmm. You say those jobs are, there are more injuries, more accidents, more sort of breakdown on the job than we know about. Just what do you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, compared to meatpacking, working at a fast food restaurant is not really a dangerous job at all. I mean, people have slips and falls and occasionally burns. But one of the things that isn't really written about is how fast food restaurants have become an extremely popular target for armed robbery, much more popular now in many cases than gas stations, convenience stores, or banks. And we had a Wendy's massacre here in New York City that got a huge amount of publicity. It was a terrible crime, and it occurred in New York, but there are all sorts of really tough armed robberies occurring every day at these places throughout the country that don't get the same amount of attention.
What about the advertising, Eric? You say kids today, many more kids know the meaning of golden arches than of the symbol of the cross, for example, and that's just the beginning.
Well, you know, worldwide, a survey found that that more people could recognize the golden arches than the Christian cross. The remarkable thing is that the marketing to children in this industry began innocently enough. In Washington, D.C., a McDonald's franchisee started having Bozo come by the store. And then when the Bozo show was canceled there, the person who played Bozo, which was Willard Scott, who later became the weatherman for the Today Show, he helped come up with a character, Ronald McDonald, who just show up at stores, the McDonald's old clown. So it started innocently enough, but now there is an enormous amount of market research and billions spent trying to figure out what children will eat and cross alliances with the major toy companies and the Hollywood film companies. And the fast food industry, along with Disney, really has perfected the marketing to children.
Mm-hmm. And what's wrong with that?
Well, you know, ultimately, it's fine except for some of the foods that they're selling. I mean, if you look at the rise in obesity among children in the United States, it's doubled since the late 1970s. And if you look at the children's meals that are being served at the fast food chains, they're incredibly high in fat and salt and sugar. And in Western Europe, a number of countries are banning the advertising of such foods because of their link to obesity.
Really? Who's banning it?
Well, Sweden, Denmark, Sweden is now head of the EU and is looking for an EU-wide ban on the marketing of these foods to kids. In the United States in the 1970s, the FTC came close to doing that until the election of Ronald Reagan kind of put that on hold.
On the back burner, so to speak. 1-800-423-8255 makes the fast food connection with Eric Schlosser. Or you can join us online at theconnection.org. Brian is on the line.
Hi. Yeah, we've been talking a lot about the dangers of the slaughterhouse. And I know there's a lot of vegetarian alternative products. You know, they have soy-based burgers that taste just like beef and soy-based chicken McNuggets that taste just like chicken. And I'm wondering if, since most of the flavor comes from chemicals anyways, wouldn't it make some sense for these big companies to move more soy-based, you know, for the environmental protection, for the protection of workers, that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm. Just eliminate the beef altogether, you mean?
The point about chemicals is a good one in the sense that if you go to a health food store and look at the packaging of many of the processed health foods, they contain flavor additives that are manufactured at exactly the same chemical plants in New Jersey that manufacture flavors for the fast food industry. So you could certainly make soy products that taste remarkably like burgers and chicken, et cetera, et cetera.
Do we know
consumer demand.
How much chicken is there in a McNugget?
There's a lot of chicken. There is a lot of chicken. There's also some water, a long list of chemicals, and chicken McNuggets contain beef extracts, among other things. It's extremely processed food, and the McNuggets actually have more fat than a hamburger. But back to the health food. These companies, I'm not trying to demonize them. They're not being run by bad men. But they're businessmen who have a very short-term view of their business and are under enormous pressure from Wall Street in terms of their quarterly profit reports. They will sell whatever people will buy. And if people want it and people demand health food on the fast food menu, McDonald's will come up with a way to sell soy burgers. So, you know, again, a lot of this ultimately comes back to the consumer. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is just so that people know what they're eating, and they can do with that knowledge what they want. But at the very least, they should know what they're putting into their bodies.
1-800-423-8255. Makes the fast food connection. Mike is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Mike.
Yeah. My name, we have a small company, a small slaughterhouse, small farm, and I guess my comment is mainly that even though we have a lot of consolidation in the meatpacking industry, there are those of us on the fringes who, because of that, have been able to capitalize on folks who are concerned about antibiotics in their meats, are concerned about where their meats come from. We sell a lot of beef in halves and quarters, and we sell pork, and we sell other things to folks who are concerned about that sort of thing.
Who do you sell it to, Mike?
We have a lot of consumers that we do the regular ConAgra and IBP beef as well. But we have quite a few people who call us and are concerned about things that are in their meat. And there's really quite a cross-section of folks. We have college professors, and we have people who work in steel mills, so to speak. This consolidation really has created a niche for us. In fact, if we didn't have that sort of consolidation in the industry, ironically, a lot of us slaughterhouses would be out of business, even though a lot of us are going out anyways. But those of us who are in an area, we're right near Syracuse, New York, and we can capitalize on those markets. And this is a fascinating topic that you have, and I agree with everything, but I did just mainly want to make the comment that there are those of us who are still in business, and there's a lot of us throughout the country who are making money in spite of the big packing plants.
Well, you know, I would argue that that what you're describing and what you're doing is really the system that we should be moving towards.
I would agree.
New Zealand relies, and that's a huge, huge meat-producing country, relies on very high-tech, very modern, very small regional slaughterhouses, and that would make sense for this country. It's the gigantic centralized slaughterhouses and grinders that are just perfect for spreading pathogens throughout the United States and even overseas.
We have a lot of small farms that we deal with that have 10, 15, 20, 25 cows, beef cows, or a small amount of hogs and such that are really doing a good job of producing, but have no market for that. You can't. They don't have the numbers to interest, say, IBP or one of these folks in coming in and purchasing their stuff. And they do a good job. A lot of them do it antibiotic-free if they need to, and so on and so forth. And there's really, I really feel that if people had that option, that more folks would actually do that.
Mike, thank you. We're going to buy your beef from now on. 1-800-423-8255. Makes the fast food connection. Jen is calling from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Jen.
My question is about KFC. There have been a lot of rumors recently about how much chicken or lack of chicken is actually in their product, and I was wondering how much you knew about that, even to the point of them not being allowed to use the word chicken in their marketing and in their restaurant.
There have been a lot of urban legends about that one from the beginning.
And I was wondering if you could actually, if you know enough about that to actually tell what's actually going on at KFC, and I can take my answer off the air.
Sure.
Well, KFC changed its name from Kentucky Fried Chicken, not because they weren't selling chicken, but because they wanted to get the fried out of the name. And, you know, KFC chicken really is made out of chicken. It's heavily processed and it's fried, so you shouldn't eat a lot of it, but there is chicken in KFC chicken.
Do you want to talk about sort of the urban legend side of Kentucky Fried Chicken? The Colonel and all that?
Well, I'm not sure which urban legends you're referring to. I mean, he was an incredible character.
Yeah, no, it was a sort of favorite repository. You could say anything you want about, you know, the chicken's feet in the McNuggets or whatever.
Well, you know, there was a chicken foot found in a McNugget recently. Again, the real problem with the food at KFC isn't that it's a mystery meat. It's a highly processed meat produced by an industrialized poultry industry that puts all kinds of things in the poultry feed that they shouldn't, and then it's very heavily fried and high fat. But it's it's not out of some strange conspiracy or mystery meat in it. Unfortunately, it's highly processed American chicken with antibiotics in it.
Finger-licking antibiotics. Nick is on the line. Are you there, Nick?
Sure. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for having the courage to address this situation. I'm wondering if you would comment on if there's anything in your book concerning employee behavior and habits at these fast food places, because I've seen some pretty nasty stuff over the years.
What do you mean? Obedience is the great virtue in these groups. What have you seen, Nick?
Well, I had the opportunity to work in one of these places for a short time. I won't mention any names. And there was just some pretty reprehensible behavior. I don't want to get too graphic, but I'm wondering if you've heard of...
Are you talking about the night you decked the manager, or are you...
No.
You mean stuff that people eat?
Yeah, concerning habits by other employees that might contaminate the food.
Well, I'll just address that. I mean, there are all kinds of things that go on when the workers aren't happy, from dropping the food on the ground and picking it up and serving it to, you know, there was a case in
upstate. This happens at the three-star restaurants, too.
It happens at all kinds of restaurants, and it's really dependent upon the manager on duty. And if the manager on duty is running a tight ship, then none of this is going on. If the workers don't like the manager and feel like they're not being treated well, all kinds of stuff happens.
Eric Schlosser, we're going out to Mom's for lunch. thank you. This is fascinating, and it's a very serious book. We all admired it around the connection. It's called Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. And you can read the first chapter on our website at theconnection.org. Good luck, Eric Schlosser. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.